Welcome to the Odelay Show, June 6, 2015 edition. Odelay Show with C.G. Braswell again today. No interview guest. Rather, this is an editorial edition of the program coming soon. However, our feature interview with an expert guest regarding the reentry and reintegration of former prisoners into society, generally further examining challenges our society faces regarding the nation's prison industrial complex, and also an interview pending about social welfare issues at the Mexico-United States international border, specifically relating to homeless children living in communities that have cropped up around garbage dumps in Nogales, Sonora, for example. This edition of the show is brought to you by Braswell Communications' latest publication, Embedded Alive, First-Person Journalism in the United States of America by C.G. Braswell, available for purchase for $19.99 by way of PayPal online banking at fusepowder.com, www.fusepowder.com, or contact me directly at 713-409-3017. This edition of the show is also brought to you by Braswell Communications' latest fiction publication from the hardboiled desk of Denver Day, Private Eye, with Pizza Noir, number one, Catch as Catch Can, available for $19.99 by way of PayPal online banking, also at www.denverday.com, DenverDay.com, or contact me directly, the aforementioned number, and we can haggle over the price. In other news, DEF CON 23 is August 6th through the 9th at Paris and Bally's in Las Vegas, Nevada. $230 for all 4 days, cash only, at the door, and there is no pre-registration. Content includes contests, unofficial and official, such as Black Bag, Crash and Compile, DEF CON Short Story Contest, Capture the Flag, Beard and Mustache Competition, DEF CON Bots, the DEF CON Darknet Project, So Hopelessly Broken, Hacker Jeopardy, OpenCTF, Scavenger Hunt, Skimiverse Championship, T.D. Francis X-Hour Film Contest. Events, official and unofficial, include 303 Sky Talks, Be the Match, DEF CON 101, DEF CON, as in you can't hear, rather than DEF. Okay, DEF CON 101, DEF CON, DEF CON Shoot, Ham Radio Exams, parties and social gatherings include official and unofficial events such as QueerCon, Villages, Crypto and Privacy Village, Hardware Hacking Village, Lockpick Village, Packet Hacking Village, Tamper Evident Village, and Wireless Village. And finally, the June 6, 2015 edition of the Odelay Show is also brought to you by Bite Size Vegan. Did you know that the animal products industry is the number one cause of climate change, even beating out the entire impact of transportation? How about the fact that we could easily feed the world's hungry with crops we currently feed our livestock? Or that a diet free of animal products is not only healthy but ideal for fighting disease? And given all of this information, what is the ethical implication of our continued consumption of animals? If this all sounds complicated and foreign, don't worry. There's a way to learn more without being overwhelmed or feeling preached to. Bite Size Vegan is Veganism Simplified. It's an ever-expanding, video-based, free educational resource for information on all aspects of veganism, consisting of a YouTube channel and accompanying website. There is a lot of information and misinformation on veganism out there. Bite Size Vegan makes it simple, fun, and approachable with info-packed, sarcasm-rich vegan nugget videos. And who says education cannot be entertaining? The vegan nuggets are just as full of sarcastic wit as they are well-researched facts. In fact, you'll have so much fun you won't even know you're learning. Just go to www.bitesizevegan.com. That's www.bitesizevegan.com and get the facts simplified. So after the Odelay Show today, go over and visit our friend Emily bite-sized vegan. Anyway, as I mentioned, this is an editorial version of the show, and this edition is the second in a series of these which describe my progress in a district court case that I've been involved with. As I had a conversation recently with an assistant United States attorney regarding his office's intention to file a motion with the court to dismiss the False Claims Act angle of my complaint, I've broken the self-imposed media silence previously in place regarding the case that I have maintained up to now. So, the case is 2014-CV-02574, filed with the United States District Court for the District of Arizona late last year at the clerk in Tucson. My petitioner's brief number 2, filed with the clerk on January 7th, 2015, is as follows. Number 1, individual civil agency defrauding the government. The vesting clauses of the United States Constitution that are Article 1, Section 1, Clause 1, Article 2, Section 1, Clause 1, and Article 3, Section 1 are instructive with respect to civil faculty of an incorporated citizen. And the language is straightforward that the lawmaking powers of the people are vested in the legislative branch, and the official powers of the people are vested in the executive branch, and the legalistic powers of the people are vested in the judicial branch. And there's no legitimate means by which a United States government official would arbitrarily contact a law-abiding, peaceable citizen in good standing to say, in essence, you will do this with your property or your wealth, or else you will suffer the government-imposed punishment. Any person who does such a thing is out of order, regardless of whether or not they understand why, and regardless of any of their affiliations or associations. And the powers vested in the three branches of the federal government are an extension of the cognitive faculty, which is to be preeminent, of course, in the function of any individual who is performing an official United States government duty of any sort, or personal duty. An individual who faces an ethical challenge, such as was widely evidently faced by the respondent in this action, regardless of whether the human agent is functioning in an official capacity or not, has nevertheless an official, so to speak, official capacity or not, has nevertheless an official duty, as if there were any official duty that were conceivable that would be in conflict with civil liberties, but has nevertheless an official duty and civil obligation to, for argument's sake, to preempt such a violation of the vested citizenry. This would be a localized example of an executive check, which all citizens in good standing have an obligation and responsibility to execute in such a circumstance. The federal executive agency is incumbent in such situations in the role of the chief executive office, for example, as an intellectual tool which serves to advocate on behalf of the citizenry in all such instances, and everybody is enfranchised to do so. The Supreme Court's considerations in Allison Engine versus the United States, 2008, provide a logical analog of the nuances of vested civil capacity or agency in an individual human agent in juxtaposition with that of the statutory notion of a United States official. Furthermore, Allison v. United States does so among a convenient context of bright-line questions about government fraud. In the Allison case, former subcontractor employees sought relief under provisions of the False Claims Act, citing misrepresentation by one of the litigants to the United States Navy regarding fulfillment of contracts financed and compensated by the Treasury. The Allison case opinion reiterates that the False Claims Act imposes civil liability on any person who knowingly uses a false record or statement to get a false or fraudulent claim paid or approved by the government, and any person who conspires to defraud the government by getting a false or fraudulent claim allowed or paid. Furthermore, we hold that it is insufficient for a plaintiff asserting a False Claims Act Section 3729A2 claim to show merely that the false statement's use resulted in obtaining or getting payment or approval of the claim, or that government money was used to pay the false or fraudulent claim. Instead, a plaintiff asserting Such a claim must prove that the defendant intended that the false record of or statement be material to the government's decision to pay or approve the false claim. Consider the sentences from the Allison opinion from a vantage of whereby the government is understood as a protocol of an individual's civil agency. It's a portion of the same which, for example, is vested in the three federal branches in the United States. The resulting silhouette is a perfect model of fraud against the United States government, which is the fundamental target of False Claims Act provisions for relief. It happens that this vantage shines a light on the scope of relief well beyond that of Civil Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act statute provisions. That's RICO in this complaint, the complaint at hand. In light of the potential breadth of the respondent's operational mode, see U.S. Code Title 31, Subtitle 37, Subchapter 3, Section 3730 regarding civil actions for false claims, and Section 3729 regarding false claims and liability, with the provisions of United States Code Title 18, Part 1, Chapter 96, and United States Code Title 42, Chapter 21, Subchapter 1, superseding the False Claims Act provision, Section 3729D. The petitioner respectfully puts to the court, pray, that one would be hard-pressed to find any American capital liquidity which is not privately guaranteed, if not also privately controlled, notions of commonwealth notwithstanding. Such a situation, even outside of the arguments about the structure of government with respect to ultimate vested authority, paints such efforts as the respondents and his or her ad hoc associates in a highly questionable operational role. It captures the respondent amid some effort of investigation about whether the individuals whom she solicits for collections are politically aware and where they are found to be ignorant regarding their liberties or misinformed due to propaganda in the at-large marketplace of ideas, then the collections effort proceeds, and ultimately a claim gets paid pursuant to some initial statement being made to the targeted individual about collections. As required for FCA complaints, as the court held in Allison, a dependency upon the initial statement or claim must be established, which is a logical assessment for the case at hand here. Also, the respondent's mode of operation seems to go further to establish intent to transgress, if not an act of outright mockery of civil status. Number two, ad hoc operators in civil RICO relief. Activities such as fraud and theft are widely and historically known, and there is a wide range of options for relief from their perpetrators, though most of them are exercises in criminal procedure. However, this complaint's brought to bear in this court because the perceived problems are, at least in part, resulting from difficulties at the federal policymaking level related to local enforcement. See the Guarantee Clause, Article 4, Section 4 of the United States Constitution. Accepting any voluntary basis or anyone or any organization to appropriate some arbitrary portion of wealth or property from any other person or any group without due process is against the law. The respondent evidently had access to and used specific information about the petitioner's personal and business operations, such as his day calendar, residential address, individually identifying government and personal data, financial information. However, that does not mean that the respondent, even if acting alone or on deep background, has any right to act upon or even possess any combination of the information. Fourth Amendment privacy protections and unenumerated Ninth Amendment protections, Fifth and Fourteenth due process protections come to mind, with supporting statutory relief by way of United States Code Title 18, Part 1, Chapter 96, Section 1961, 1A, with respect to extortion, and 1B, with respect to extortionate credit transactions, correlated to the penalty rate in a letter from Austin that came to the petitioner, and related to fraud and related activity in connection with access devices or in connection with identification documents, such as egressing the petitioner's personal information and mail fraud and financial institution fraud, and relating even to peonage with respect to ostensible recurring identity theft and contributing to ongoing years-long systemic violations of the same type against the petitioner and others like him. Examples of fraud by way of the mail or fraud by misapplication of a standard-bearing entity or through fraudulent financial claims all share a common aspect. That is the use of paper tools, or as the common law has it, by some writ of authority. And any such illegitimate writs are naturally constructed to appear bona fide in purporting actual authority. Writs of attainder do not typically explicitly notify the recipient or the affected parties by way of declaring, "This is an outright bill of goods." The petitioner is cautious about invoking any misunderstanding by the court that his complaint targets anyone except the respondent in her personal, intellectual, cognitive, and legalistic capacity as an individual human agent who happens to enjoy United States citizenship for failure to fulfill her vested obligations as a United States citizen. Challenges of bills of attainder, constitutional, see Article 1, Section 9, Clause 3 of the United States Constitution. While they are excellent fundamental models for illustrating fraudulent institutional mechanisms, nevertheless most often reach the federal courts consequent to some legislated rule, so application of the law therewith frequently occurs at an organizational or agency level. The same imminent point can be easily made regarding the 13th Amendment's abolition of slavery and involuntary servitude, and the 14th Amendment exception for state actor or state action with respect to the abolition. Notwithstanding the ensuing black codes that still are prevalent today. And this is probably some dereliction of, I feel certain of it, to wit, by the federal rule of law regarding violations of civil liberties, actual civil and criminal transgressions both are said to occur at the hand of the actor. In fact, see United States Code, Title 42, Chapter 21, Subchapter 1, Section 1985, 3, and Section 1986. Regarding action for neglect to prevent violations of civil rights. Therefore, the respondent should not succeed in invoking any official capacity defense to seek political quarter for his or her actions. As the petitioner in this action herein establishes that her duties and operations are unconstitutional and in violation of the petitioner's due process and privacy protections affirmed in the Fourth and Fifth Amendment, as well as by way of various unenumerated provisions of the Ninth Amendment and Tenth Amendment reaffirmations, such as with respect to the civil power vested in the petitioner to bring this action, as well as the respondent's vested civil capacity, which capitally obligates her to intercede such a transgression that she has facilitated and put upon the petitioner instead. See United States Code, Title 42, Chapter 21, Subchapter 1, Section 1983, regarding provisions for civil action for deprivation of civil rights. So, keeping in mind the aforementioned caveats regarding responsibilities for individual cognitive agency as it relates to bright-line transgression of civil liberties that may occur through the wielding of a seemingly authoritative writ, the disposition of the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit in Acorn versus United States in 2010, reiterates the identification of the three elements that amount to a bill of attainder, to wit. 1, specification of the affected persons. 2, punishment. And 3, lack of a judicial trial. This case argues that Braswell v. Younger argues that, number one, the petitioner is specifically affected in his liberties by the defendant's fraudulent collection efforts. In a, number two, punitive sense, as it disenfranchises the petitioner from his individual civil sovereignty and good standing, and even as a taxpayer, inasmuch as it disrupts his free application or disposal of his real or intellectual property in the due course of his role as a head of household, a business owner, and an American citizen, and thereby the petitioner suffers the consequences of a non-egalitarian, number three, de facto class action adjudication by writ, see text 16th Amendment, implemented by the erstwhile, with all due respect, 61st Congress of the United States. Again, see U.S. Code, Title 42, Chapter 21, Subchapter 1, Section 1988A, regarding the applicability of statutory or common law for proceedings in the vindication of civil rights. The respondent, failing the foremost obligation of her purported capacity as a vested government official, to put into check such an unconstitutional operation, therefore, is liable by her, by right of her natural agency as an individual. See Title 42, regarding provisions for civil action for deprivation of civil rights. Anza v. Ideal Steel, 2006 case, provides a vantage from the Supreme Court regarding application of the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, wherein the Supreme Court has been inclined toward establishing proximate cause rather than but-for causality, as defendants in the case argued. As follows, that RICO's private right of action must be interpreted in light of common law principles, and that at common law, a fraud action requires the plaintiff to prove reliance. Because Ideal has not satisfied the proximate cause requirement articulated in Holmes, we have no occasion to address the substantial question whether a showing of reliance is required. Braswell argues reliance in addition to proximate cause. And without the letter from the respondent, the petitioner would have had no natural compulsion to tender payment. Therefore, the ensuing sequence of events occurred as a direct result of the respondent's solicitation, and the petitioner relied upon the information to the extent that he paid the amount that was solicited by the respondent after the sum was communicated to the petitioner, along with a letter denying his application for extension of time for payment of tax due to undue hardship. I was broke, namely. The respondent's letter sought the same amount as was sought by the financial collections document mailed to the petitioner from Austin, Texas, that additionally assessed a 0.5% penalty rate to the outstanding amount. Braswell paid the amount demanded, in person at a physical location where he went through an electronically invasive security checkpoint staffed by lethally armed guards, where he and his 8-year-old son were also ordered to remove their shoes and belt and empty the contents of their pocket. And such historically clamorous displays of institutionalized public force among the cottage industry which surrounds federal income tax collection reinforces the petitioner's inclination to rely on the tax collector's willingness and ability to command collection, in fact, under penalty. One of the reasons Petitioner Braswell is in pro se is because during two separate consultations with Phoenix area attorneys, both lawyers characterized such a case as this one, Braswell v. Unger, to be legalistically futile, and both of them indicated that such an action would be viewed in a negative light by their respective bar associations, and both stated that such an effort on the petitioner's part would result in a real threat to the complainant's person, family, and liberty. With that, such an ad hoc political display of private complicity with the cottage industry that surrounds so-called federal income collection that appears to have also permeated the bar, the legal bar, also reinforces the petitioner's estimation regarding the political willingness and boots-on-the-ground ability of the tax collector and her ad hoc organization to collect on the amount solicited. And the whole affair stinks of organized crime amid a cottage industry that is sympathetic to it, frankly. The Anza case also addresses certain nuances with respect to the willingness, complicity, awareness, and intent of the business end agent of an alleged racketeering operation or other criminal syndicate, such as would conceivably include the degree to which private investigations were applied to by the respondent's operation. In light of the original intent of the RICO provisions, such as regarding prohibited activities enforceable under the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, to eliminate the infiltration of organized crime and racketeering into legitimate organizations operating in interstate commerce, unlike those alleged hereupon. Regarding investigations, privacy, and a reasonable expectation for freedom to implement one's day-to-day means, it is worth noting that since 2002, 13 years, the petitioner in Braswell v. Unger has been a working journalist in the due course of which he regularly provides reportage and collaborates with local government, federal officials, and law enforcement agencies in multiple states, most frequently pro bono, and conducts civil and other legalistic discovery to include credentialed public and private investigations. At this point in his career, the petitioner realizes that certain means by which certain governmental and non-governmental organizations and privately held corporations and otherwise operators of a particular class or disposition use questionable means which regularly transgress American civil liberties and which impede the petitioner's ability to negotiate sensitive sources, to guarantee confidentiality, and to sufficiently implement his own effective forensic protocols, etc., 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 while at the same time attending to the ongoing safety of himself and his family, as well as contributing to that of the ambient community at large, friends and neighbors, to even adversaries. civil liberties ought to remain intact. Otherwise, they have no cause to respect one's own civil liberties. As noted editorially in the previous petitioner's brief, the protocol implemented by the respondent and her interstate associates is indistinguishable from some of the more flagrant in-bad-faith market operators, such as those who repeatedly hound victims for mail-based collections. Also, after 13 years in his current vocational mode, it becomes increasingly clear to the petitioner that such operations or operators are out of order regardless of their umbrella affiliation or logo, and that they do indeed continue to victimize people wherever they are not formally and firmly interdicted. And regarding such logos, they happen to be, in this case, doing it in my name, if they're functioning as the United States government, because I'm a citizen. The ANZA case weighs consideration regarding a syndicate's use and investment of racketeering proceeds as distinct from injury traceable simply to the predicate acts of racketeering alone or to the conduct of the business of the enterprise. And while it is not clear how Petitioner Braswell's individual tax dollars were or are to be appropriated locally or otherwise, although there are some somewhat speculative nationwide percentages published by the Office of the President of the United States, the amount paid by the petitioner in 2014 and all previous years is a known quantity. ANZA also makes an affirmation about compensable injury, see Title 18 regarding provisions for civil remedies, that correlates civil liability with the footprint of a pattern. That is, citing a SEDIMA case, necessarily is the harm, S-E-D-I-M-A, necessarily is the harm caused by predicate acts sufficiently related to constitute a pattern, for the essence of the violation is the commission of those acts in connection with the conduct of an enterprise. Close quote. These items have implications regarding the ambient scope of the respondent's operation, and therefore implications regarding the path ahead for discovery in Braswell. In the Braswell case, please reference government investigative protocols stipulated in the following rules. Title 18, Section 1968, regarding civil investigative demand. Also, Title 18, Section 1967, regarding evidence presented in court. The ANZA case also notes the subject of indictable mail fraud, see Title 18, Section 1341, provisions defining frauds and swindles as a RICO investigation qualifier. Copies of the complaint in the Braswell QI-TAM action were provided to the United States Attorney General in the District of Columbia, see Title 18, Section 1965 regarding venue and process, Title 18, Section 1964A regarding civil remedies, as well as to the United States Attorney General for the District of Arizona and Tucson, see Title 18, Section 1964B and D regarding civil remedies, Title 18, Section 1968 regarding civil investigative demand, Title 18, Section 1966 regarding expedition of actions, and Title 42, Section 1988 regarding proceedings in vindication of civil rights. Also regarding procedure for potential consideration of relief under provisions of the False Claims Act, see Title 31, Section 3731 regarding false claims procedure, Section 3732 regarding false claims jurisdiction, Section 3733 regarding civil investigative demands for false claims. 3. Economic landscape and marketplace opportunity. So activities such as those with which the respondent is involved in this case are more widely effective and successful in marketplace environments where the rights and liberties of the community members are not clearly trumpeted. The respondent is named as an individual and not in her official capacity, as discussed above. However, of the following economic situations noted below, in addition to the situations conducive to cottage industries as summarized in petitioner's brief number one, the previous one, that is, contribute to the ambient clamor and general lack of clarity that enable such in-bad-faith schemes as illegitimate tax collection operations, which operate under a federal executive seal, to take hold and thrive in a given community, apparently repeatedly victimizing various groups and individuals, illustrating another ethical compulsion for Braswell's complaint, that is, as an action brought due to a civil obligation to stop and render aid, as it were. There remains optimistic expectations that the United States Congress understands its power of the purse in the context of the United States economy in the 21st century. However, regional Financial institutions are also key contributors to manifestations of off-the-mark de facto policy and the emergence of parasitic financial cottage industries by which all in-good-faith marketplace operators are negatively impacted. A representative array of such regional operators who overhedge on the dollar as a sort of vanity or as a commodity and status symbol of wealth, rather than focus in their applications of and their marketplace interactions with the dollar as a tool, capital E, have recently found their constitutional separation of powers and due process arguments against progressive policies such as the Federal Reserve System to have been dispatched in the United States District Court for the District of Columbia and State National Bank of Big Spring versus Jacob J. Lew, for example, 2013 case. Therein, the court in essence upheld an interpretation that Federal Reserve notes are a tool, not a vanity or status symbol, and therefore even states cannot have a real property right, so to speak, to any such manifestation on paper of such a policy or statute. And it's not only just because such a property right essentially makes into real property the people whose vested executive authority are thereby coerced. I can't spell it out any more clearly. I guess I do several times over and over again, but this is a functional gist of my point. So in the State National Bank of Big Spring v. Jacob J. Lew, to quote from it, however, the court is unconvinced that the states have a present injury because the state's underlying premise that they have a property right in the configuration of the bankruptcy code is flawed. The case documents read, Simply put, the state's holding of certain statutory rights does not amount to an inalienable property right under the bankruptcy code. So that is to say, my interpretation, that one cannot cash a bill, one cannot use money as food, and a state must view the federal currency as statute, not property. Represents agency, not land or handcuffs. It can underwrite transactions for those items if the community is in support of such a transaction, but they are not those items, and they're not to be used as them. Furthermore, the court essentially put forth that from a national perspective, that is the general federal administrative realm, which includes the Treasury and the Federal Reserve System, the administration of the dollar is one that must be as quick and essential for use in liquidating assets as it can be for underwriting them. Remind you, and with such decisions wholly governed by the greater best interest rather than being influenced by any accumulated quantity of cash value or individual or regional status of privilege or wealth in dollars. Case documents go on to orderly liquidation authority could be used if and only if the failure of the financial company would threaten United States financial stability. Close quote. Optimism about the federal legislature notwithstanding, disorientation regarding federal fiscal policy as applied in local jurisdictions is evident, presumably due to a lack of cohesion among the executive administration of various funding mechanisms, which are available to the three branches of the federal government, and with myriad economic consequences, for example. See, and I've given it a general order number 13-21 for the United States District Court for the District of Arizona filed October 9, 2013 regarding the impasse between the legislative branch and the executive branch of the United States with respect to funding for its judicial branch. About 102 years ago and some 10 months after the adoption of the 16th Amendment in the year 1913, when the Federal Reserve Act was signed into law, Title 12, Section 341C, General Enumeration of Powers for the Federal Reserve System, for example. Good reference there. The would-be official status of the respondent was formally, in the 100-odd years ago, mooted. Barring the respondent's Democratic election as a federal income tax collector in this local jurisdiction, which I don't recall, because it didn't happen. As was necessary, such behavior as the respondents as a class was again restrained with the formal abolition of peonage in 1957. Title 42, Section 1994. Dated January 5th, Christy Braswell in pro se. So that's the Yodelay show for the 6th of June, 2015. Thanks for listening. There's more of that to come. It's a lot. If you prefer to just read it yourself rather than having it read to you, you can go to www.pacer.gov, which is where courts have records of all of this dialogue. All sorts of interesting cases are there, of course, but this is the one that I'm focused on now. And if you would prefer to read it rather than having it read to you, go there and have at it. The case number again is 14-CV-02574-TUC-JAS. Filed it in December, last month, last year. Stay tuned for more of these and upcoming interviews as well on the Odelay Show with C.T. Braswell. And thanks for listening. Good day.